Hui felt the quick stab of doubt through his superstitious awe. He placed his hands on Tani's shoulders and held her away to study her face. Her eyes were reddened, and tears had washed her cheeks. But still he was suspicious. It seemed just a little too neat. And he'd learnt that when Tanith set her heart on something, she was not easily put off.
"Tanith," he said severely, "you know how grave a matter it is to misrepresent the words of the gods."
Tanith nodded fervently.
"Oh, yes, my lord."
"As a seeress, you have a sacred duty," Hui insisted.
And Tanith wiped her cheeks and remembered how Hui had used that sacred duty to steer the political and economic life of the nation, not to mention his personal profit. She could not deny herself a wicked pleasure in paying him in his own coin.
"I know it well, Holy Father." Hui stared at her, but could find no evidence of guilt.
Unable to withstand the scrutiny of those dark eyes a moment longer, Tanith buried her face in his neck once more and waited silently. The silence lasted a long time before Hui finally admitted defeat.
"Very well," he gruffed. "I'll keep you with me, if that is what the goddess wants."
And Tanith hugged him closer and smiled triumphantly into Hui Ben Ammon's curly beard. For 5 days, Hui probed and tested that moving mass of humanity as it flowed on towards the great river like a vast black jellyfish. Always he moved back, retreating ahead of it, keeping his tiny force compact and well under his hand, using it with economy and purpose. On the 5th day, he linked up with a garrison at Set. Mago, the elderly commander, placed himself under Hui with 1,800 archers and light infantry, 12 war elephants, 2 patrol galleys of 100 oars each, and the garrison's considerable arsenal. Hui greeted him in the heated noonday on a small hill 12 miles south of the river, and he led Mago aside out of earshot of the staff.
"I'm honored to serve under you, for Holy Father. They say there is glory for those that follow the standard of the Sunbird."
"There will be enough glory for all here, I warrant you," Hui told him grimly, and pointed across the open forest land.
"There they are."
The slave army moved like a thick column of foraging ants, and the pale mist of dust rose above the trees.
"What thoughts come first to your mind, Captain?" Hui asked quietly.
And Mago studied the distant army.
"From here, my lord, they look like any other army on the march," he muttered doubtfully.
"And does that not strike you as odd?" "This is not an army, Mago. It's a rabble of escaped slaves. And yet, it moves like an army."
Mago nodded quickly, understanding. "Yes, yes. They're in hand. Yes, you can see it. It's true. You would not expect such control."
"There is more to it than that," Hui told him. "You will see it demonstrated in a moment, for I have arranged a little entertainment. I believe in giving these slaves plenty of pepper in their diet. We will raid their baggage in a moment, and then you will see what I mean." They were silent for a moment, watching the enemy move slowly down towards them. And then Hui asked,
"What's the state of the river, Mago?"
"My lord, it is very, very low."
"The ford is passable," Hui insisted. "How deep is it?" "It can be crossed on foot. The water at the deepest is neck deep, but flowing fast. I've had the guide ropes cut."
Hui nodded.
"They're moving towards the ford at Set. I've been sure of that from the moment when they chose the Lululu Pass of the escarpment."
Hui was silent a moment longer.
"That is where I will destroy them," he went on firmly.
And Mago glanced sideways at him. Destroy seemed a strange word for a general of 3,000 men to use in connection with an army of 30,000.
"My lord," one of Hui's officers shouted, "the attack begins!"
And Hui hurried across to join the group.
"Ah," he said with satisfaction, Backmore has chosen his moment well.
From their carefully prepared ambush, Backmore's 500 heavy infantrymen charged into the flank of the column. Huey's favorite had peaked a weak spot in the protective screen of black spearmen. His axemen hacked their way through to the baggage train, and the drivers of the bullock wagons jumped from their seats and ran. The women bearers dropped the baskets of grain from their heads and followed them in a shrieking panic. Swiftly the attackers slaughtered the oxen in their traces and piled the grain baskets in heaps. Fire from the earthenware pots was fanned to life, and within minutes the plundered food stores of the slave army was ablaze. "Look," Huey pointed out to Mago, the response of the slaves to this sudden onslaught. From head and tail of the column, formations of spearmen were doubling back and forward in the classical maneuver of envelopment. The movement was not executed with any of the precision of a trained legion. It was slow and unwieldy, a mere parody of the correct formations, but it was recognizable.
"Remarkable," Mago exclaimed. "A soldier commands them, or one at least who has read the military statutes. Your officer must be careful now."
"Backmore knows what to do," Huey assured him. And as he spoke, the distant axemen formed up quickly into the testudo formation, an armored tortoise of shields, and they trotted out between the enclosing arms of spearmen, beating the encircling movement with minutes to spare. Behind them, the baggage train burnt, smearing black smoke across the treetops.
"Good, good,"
Huey grinned his pleasure and relief, slapping his thigh with pleasure.
"Sweetly done. Now let the slave commander show if he is as great a quartermaster as he is a tactician. There'll be growling bellies in the enemy camp tonight."
Huey took Mago's arm and led him away.
"A bowl of wine," he suggested. "Watching and waiting is almost as thirsty work as swinging the axe."
Mago smiled.
"Speaking of wine, Holiness, I have a few amphorae of wine that I'm sure will give no offence even to the palate as knowledgeable as yours. Will you dine with me this night?"
"I look forward to it with the keenest anticipation," Huey assured him. The wine was drinkable, and after the meal Huey and Tanith sang together for the guests. It was a fanciful piece of pornography of Huey's composition, a love duet between Baal and Astarte. Tanith sang the part of the goddess in a sweet and true voice, rendering the more suggestive and ambiguous lines with modestly downcast eyes that had the guests shouting with laughter and pounding the board with their wine bowls. Huey ignored the pleas for an encore, and setting his lute aside, he became serious. He spoke of the impending battle, warning Mago and his officers not to judge the enemy too lightly.
"I nearly paid dearly for that mistake," he told them. "I was tempted to probe their center in strength, and I found it as soft as freshly kneaded dough. I sensed a quick rout, a chance of victory at a single stroke. With their center collapsing, I would drive through them and split them."
Huey paused and made the sun sign.
"Praise unto Baal. But a moment before I gave the order to commit and change the probe to a full frontal attack, I was warned by an impulse from the gods."
The company assumed expressions of suitable religious solemnity, and a few of them made the sun sign as Huey went on. "I looked to the enemy's flanks, which naturally overlapped mine, and I saw how firmly they stood. It seemed to me that the enemy's steadiest and best troops were posted there. And suddenly I remembered Cannae. I remembered how Hannibal had enmeshed the Roman consul." Huey broke off suddenly, and an expression of revelation dawned upon his face. "Cannae. Hannibal." Clearly he remembered the clay box with the battle counters of Cannae set out upon it. He remembered his own voice lecturing, and a black face, intent and listening.
"Timon," he whispered. "It's Timon. It must be."
Around him lay his army, a vast agglomeration of black humanity, hungry, afraid, and restless in the night.
The fires blossomed like a flower garden upon the southern bank of the great river, and the night sky glowed orange. The fires were for warmth alone. There was no food. There had been no food for 2 days now, not since they had burnt his baggage. Timon moved silently amongst them and saw how they huddled about the fires. Hunger had made them cold, and they whispered and moaned, so the sound of his camp was murmurous, a sibilance like the hive sound of wild bees. He hated them. They were slaves, weaklings. 1 in 50 of them was a man, and 1 in 100 was a warrior. When he had longed for a war spear in his hands, they had been a rotten twig. They were slow and clumsy in response to the lightning sallies of the enemy. 50 of them were no match for 1 of the splendid warriors that opposed him. He longed for the men of his own tribe, longed to teach them what he had learnt, to imbue them with his own sense of purpose, his own dreams of destiny and retribution. On the bank of the river he stood and looked across at the slick black flow of water. The reflection of the stars danced upon the surface, and at the shallow place of the ford there were whirls and eddies, a disturbance, as though some monster swam deep. 300 paces out, halfway across the river, was a small islet. The floodwaters would cover it, and it was thick with driftwood and mats of stranded papyrus. This was the first stage of the fort. It was here that he would anchor his lines of twisted bark that his men were plaiting now. He would rig the lines at dawn and attempt to make the crossing in a single day. He knew how heavy his losses must be. They were weak with hunger and wounds and exhaustion. The bark ropes were unreliable. The current was swift and treacherous, and the enemy was as swift and unrelenting. Timon moved away downstream, passing among his sentries, talking quietly with them, stopping to examine the huge coils of bark rope that were laid ready upon the bank, and at last he came to the perimeter of his camp. Downstream was the garrison of Set, 1,000 paces away, a Roman mile, as Timon now thought of it. There were torches burning upon the walls, and Timon could see the sentries moving vigilantly in the light. Out in the river, anchored in a deep, placid pool, were the galleys of the river patrol. With oars shipped and sails furled, they were saurian in shape, and Timon watched them uneasily. He'd never seen warships in action, and he didn't know what to expect of them. When Hui Ben Ammon had spoken of the great sea battles of the Romans and the Greeks and the Carthaginians, he had paid scant attention. He regretted it now. He wished he could form some estimate of the threat that these strange craft afforded his crossing. The sound of voices came faintly to him across the water, and though he could not recognize the words, yet the familiar modulations of the Punic language fanned his hatred. He listened to them, and he felt it come up out of the pit of his belly. He wanted to hurl himself upon them and destroy them. He wanted to destroy every trace, every memory of this grotesque, light-skinned people, with their skills and strength and strange gods and monstrous cruelties. Standing in the darkness and staring at the distant fortress, hearing their voices in the night, he remembered the body of his woman, sliding and bouncing over the rough ground. He remembered the slaves wailing in the compounds of Julia. He remembered the slave's smell, the sound and kiss of the lash, the jangling weight of the chains, the searing heat of the rock, the voice of the slave masters, the 1,000 other memories burnt and branded into his brain. He massaged the thickened chain calluses at his wrist and stared at his enemies. And from the core of his soul, his hatred bubbled and boiled, threatening to flood his reason like the red-hot lava of an active volcano. He wanted to swing his army about and fall upon them. He wanted to destroy them, to destroy every last trace of them. He found with surprise that he was shaking, his whole body shuddering with the force of his hatred. And with an immense effort of his will, he controlled himself. Sweat poured down his face and chest in the night, cool, the rank-smelling sweat of hatred. "My time is not now," he thought, "but it will come." There was a presence beside him in the darkness, and he turned to it.
"Zama?" he asked, and his lieutenant answered softly, "The dawn is coming."
"Yes," Timon nodded. "It is time to begin."
With loving attention, Tanith braided his beard, and then twisted it up under his chin and clubbed it out of the way where it wouldn't catch in Hui's breastplate, nor afford a grip for a desperate enemy. She whispered endearments as she worked, the endearments of a childless woman, speaking to him as though he were her infant. Hui sat quietly on his couch, delighting in the deft and gentle touch of her hands, the soft words, and the loving tone of her voice. All this contrasted so violently with what the day would bring, and when Tanith rose from the couch and went to fetch his heavy breastplate, he felt a sharp sense of loss. She helped him to arm, kneeling to buckle the straps of his greaves, fussing with the folds of his cloak, and although she smiled, he could hear the fear in her voice. He kissed her awkwardly, and the iron crushed her breast as he held her. She made a small movement of protest, half pulling away, and then she surrendered to his embrace and, ignoring the pain, pressed herself to him. "Oh, Hui," she whispered, "my lord, my love." The old priestess pulled aside the hanging reed mat and stepped into the chamber. She saw the two of them clinging to each other, oblivious of all else. Aina stared at them through rheumy old eyes, and then her mouth sagged open into a toothless grin, and she drew back silently and let the reed mat fall into place. Tanith drew away at last. She went to the wall against which the vulture axe leaned beside Hui's couch, and she took it up and untied the soft leather sheath from the blade. She came to Hui, standing before him, and she lifted the blade to her lips and kissed it. "Fail him not," she whispered to the axe, and handed it to Hui. In the pre-dawn darkness, there was an eager group of officers on the ramparts of the fort, staring upstream to where the slave army was encamped. They were all armed and were eating the morning meal as they stood. They greeted Hui and Tanith with boisterous high spirits, and Tanith watched and listened as they discussed the day. She found it difficult to understand how they could face the possibility of dealing or receiving death with the enthusiasm of small boys for a piece of mischief. Tanith felt herself excluded from this mysterious male camaraderie, and she was startled by the change which had come over Hui. Her gentle poet, her solemn scholar and shy lover, was as inflamed as any of them. She recognized all the signs of his excitement, in his fluttering hand gestures, the hectic spots of colour in his cheeks, and the high-pitched giggle with which he greeted one of Backmore's sallies. "This is the day. Enough waiting," Hui declared, as he stared upstream into the dawn gloom. There was a heavy mist upon the river, and the smoke from 10,000 campfires obscured the field. He paced restlessly. "A curse upon this mist! I can't see if they've strung their lines across the ford yet."
"Shall I order one of the galleys upstream to investigate?" Mago asked.
"No," Hui waved the suggestion aside. "We'll know soon enough, and I don't want to draw attention to the galleys yet."
Hui crossed to the parapet on which the food was spread. He poured a bowl of hot wine sweetened with honey and raised it to the company.
"A bright edge to your swords!"
Hui sang the greeting to Bale as the sun came up over a red and smoky horizon, and then, standing bareheaded, he drew the attention of the gods to the fact that he intended fighting a battle this day. In strong but respectful terms, he pointed out that though the men he commanded were the finest, yet the odds were high, and he would need assistance if the day was to be carried. He relied on them for their cooperation. He made the sun sign, and then turned briskly to his staff.
"Very well. You know your stations and duties."
As they dispersed, Hui led Backmore aside.
"You have a man to attend the priestess?"
Backmore beckoned to a grizzled old infantryman, who stood a short way off, and the man came forward.
"You know your duties?" Hui demanded, and the soldier nodded.
I'll remain with the priestess through the day. Never letting her out of your sight, Hui cautioned him. Should the enemy triumph, and it seems she will fall into their hands, I will.
Yes, good, Hui interrupted him gruffly. If it is necessary, make the stroke swift and sure.
Hui could not look at Tanith. He turned away quickly and went down to where a small boat waited to row him out to the largest of the two galleys. Hui stood on the castle of the galley and waited. The sun was well up now, and the mist was dispersed. The galley was singled up to a bow anchor, and she faced into the current. The rowers were at their benches, their shields and weapons laid at their feet, the oars feathered and ready.